Nuclear betrayal. After the end of World War II, the United States wanted to proceed with its atomic weapons programs, but they needed some place to test their weapons and determine the impact. So the U.S. military went to the Marshall Islands. Located in the Pacific Ocean, midway between Australia and Hawaii, with the intent of convincing the peaceful residents to evacuate their ancestral lands and allow big bombs to blow the islands of the Bikini Atoll to radioactive smithereens. To accomplish their ends, the U.S. did what it so frequently has done in matters nuclear. They lied to the people and their chiefs, and with false guarantees of safety, coerced them into a nightmare they did not see coming and from which they have not yet emerged. Listen up as a genuine expert tells you.
There are some really remarkable videos, footage out there that the U.S. created of their leaders speaking to the Bikinian leaders and explaining that this testing and their evacuation, the Bikinian people's evacuation from their island, was necessary for world peace. It was put in very simple and grand terms that would suggest that if the Bikinian people were to reject the request, that they would somehow then be responsible for more war.
What a load of... Well, that was only the start of the lies and cruelties that the United States inflicted on the people of the Marshall Islands, who, in addition to the atomic bomb victims in Japan, became the frontline guinea pigs used and radioactively abused for decades in an attempt by the U.S. to justify that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who already know something who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we examine the betrayal, ongoing plight, and challenges faced by the people of the Marshall Islands through the lens of a film about what happened to them and where they are now. The film is Nuked, an award-winning documentary currently picked up for dissemination and distribution by the Al Jazeera Media Network. We talk with director Andrew Nisker and Rhea Moss Christian, a Marshall Islander interviewed in the film who has chaired the Marshall Islands National Nuclear Commission and advised the Marshall Islands government on oceans and trade. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, and lots more honest and verified nuclear information. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, January 27, 2026, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out with this morning's big announcement by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, the annual resetting of the doomsday clock, a symbolic measurement of how close humanity is to wiping itself off the face of the Earth. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists set the clock at 85 seconds before midnight, the theoretical point of annihilation. That is 4 seconds closer than it was set last year and is the closest it has ever been to midnight. The Chicago-based nonprofit created the clock in 1947 during the Cold War tensions that followed World War II to warn the public about how close humankind was to destroying the world. This year, citing aggressive behavior by nuclear powers Russia, China, and the United States, fraying nuclear arms control, conflicts in Ukraine and the Middle East, and AI worries, among other factors, is what drove the risk for global disaster and led to the setting of the time. According to nuclear policy expert Alexandra Bell, who is the Bulletin's president and CEO, no matter the government, a shift towards neo-imperialism and an Orwellian approach to governance will only serve to push the clock towards midnight. Of course, the doomsday clock is about global risks, and what we have seen is a global failure in leadership. No matter the government, a shift towards neo-imperialism and an Orwellian approach to governance will only serve to push the clock towards midnight. This was the third time in the past 4 years that the scientists moved the clock closer to midnight. In terms of nuclear risks, nothing in 2025 trended in the right direction, Bell said. Long-standing diplomatic frameworks are under duress or collapsing. The threat of explosive nuclear testing has returned. Proliferation concerns are growing. And there were three military operations taking place under the shadow of nuclear weapons and the associated escalatory threat. The risk of nuclear use is unsustainably and unacceptably high. She pointed at Russia's continued war in Ukraine, the U.S. and Israel bombing of Iran, and border clashes between India and Pakistan. She also cited continuing tensions in Asia, including on the Korean Peninsula, and China's threats towards Taiwan, as well as the rising tensions in the Western Hemisphere since U.S. President Donald Trump returned to office 12 months ago. The last remaining nuclear arms pact between the United States and Russia, the New START Treaty, expires on February 5th. Russian President Vladimir Putin proposed in September that the two countries agree to observe for another year the limits set under the pact, which caps each side's number of deployed nuclear warheads at 1,550. That is more than enough to blow up the world. Trump has not formally responded. We'll have a PDF of the 2026 Doomsday Clock Statement by the Science and Security Board of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists linked on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 761. In trying to focus on nuclear issues, we need to melt ice, but not reactors. Here's Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
As I stare at the thick blanket of snow outside my windows, it's been hard not to focus on the extreme cold and ice. But it's not the weather that is occupying my thoughts. It's the cold, heartless inhumanity of Trump and his thugs inside the White House, and of course the appalling ICE assassins he has unleashed on our streets and in our communities. Other absurdities, the ballroom, the Peace Prize, the triumphal Trump arch, have been laughable distractions. But all memes are off now. We are at the Rubicon. How then to redirect our attention to the nuclear issues when there are so many near-term emergencies? After all, for those of us who are on the older side, all the bluster about new so-called advanced reactors will not amount to anything tangible in our lifetimes. So should we even worry about them? Yes, because we must think of the generations to come, if there are to be any, and much of whether or not they are to survive rests on successfully curbing Trump's authoritarian wrecking ball, whose damage extends far beyond the boundaries of this country. The legacy we may or may not leave behind us truly hangs in the balance now. Because in the midst of all the other horrors and tragedies that are playing out here and across the world every day, the climate crisis is quietly and quickly worsening. That's why when the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists announces the time on its doomsday clock each year, it no longer takes into account only the threat of nuclear war. It also factors the deadly outcome of a failure to address our climate crisis adequately or in time. The climate crisis is being made worse by our continued overuse of fossil fuels, but also by prioritizing nuclear power development. There are two principal reasons for this. The first one is cost, and that drives the other reason, time. Because nuclear power is the most expensive form of electricity in the world, it is not readily embraced by the financial sector and even by energy corporations. New nuclear plants cannot happen without massive subsidies, and possibly not even then. This means new nuclear power resources take a long time to arrive. What happens in the meantime? The answer should be a rapid deployment of renewable energy, and miraculously that is still happening to some extent, despite efforts by the Trump regime to obliterate it. As Ken Bosong, who has been running the invaluable Sunday campaign for decades, reported recently, in 2025, renewables sources provided 26% of U.S. electricity, with solar at 9% and wind at 10%. Installed solar capacity is now greater than coal and double that of nuclear power. All new net capacity in 2026 may be renewable as battery storage grows by 56%. But what also happens as we wait for the new nuclear plants that may never be is a continued reliance on fossil-fueled power plants. That's the case with the onslaught of new, massive, energy-guzzling data centers. The big tech oligarchs who own them, including Amazon, Meta, and Google, may say they're going to use nuclear power to feed them. But none of the new reactors exist, and the old closed ones, like Three Mile Island that they want to revive, are far from fit for service. So what they are actually using is fossil fuel energy. For example, the Washington Post reported that a data center being built in Homer City, Pennsylvania, will use 7 gas-powered stations to create more power than is used by all the residents of the Philadelphia metropolitan area. This is terrible news for climate change abatement, says Jean Su, Energy Justice Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. The U.S. is about to set off on an explosion of dirty data center emissions, entrenching more fossil fuels when we need their rapid phase-out. One of the chief culprits here is the disappointingly awful governor of New York, Kathy Hochul. Food and Water Watch, which is leading the fight against data center expansion, accuses Hochul of, quote, laying out the red carpet for big tech by pushing dirty energy, and that she is set to, quote, greenlight 2 frack gas pipelines that we helped stop years ago, and she's promoting dangerous nuclear power. You'd think our political leaders could do some basic math here and work out that waiting for nuclear and relying on fossil fuels is not only environmentally and morally wrong, but actually the most expensive route in the long term. But with a few shining exceptions, we've clearly chosen the wrong people for higher office. After all, after mother of three Renee Good had already been murdered by ICE agents in Minneapolis, and a day before ICU nurse Alex Preti was assassinated by ICE there, a majority in the U.S. House of Representatives, including 7 shameful Democrats, voted to send yet more millions into ICE's coffers so that they can continue their lawless and murderous rampages in our cities. Congress is likewise directing potentially billions of our dollars to fund dubious and dangerous new nuclear projects, often for data centers that we arguably don't need and which are already sending consumer electricity rates sky high while the big tech CEOs rake in the profits. So much needs to stop right now. The hatred, the violence, the unfettered fascism that is growing more dangerous here by the day. What also needs to stop is the uncontrolled expansion of energy use at a time when we need to be doing the exact opposite. That means cancelling all new nuclear reactor projects, and arguably for now, all new data centres, and concentrating on the resources we already have. Sunshine can melt ice. Its warmth also needs to start melting hearts. We need to abolish ice, and also nukes. There are too many nightmares to contend with already. We don't need to add the inevitable next nuclear disaster to the mix. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
Here's this week's featured interview. It's always good news when an honest film about nuclear issues gets signed for general distribution. And that's what just happened, as Al Jazeera Media Network picked up the 2024 film Nuked. It presents the story of the U.S. nuclear betrayal of the people of the Marshall Islands after World War II. The film was released in 2024 and won several awards, including Best Documentary at the 2024 International Uranium Film Festival. March 1st marks Marshallese Remembrance Day, formerly known as Nuclear Victims Day and Nuclear Survivors Day. It's a national holiday in the Marshall Islands, which honors the victims and survivors of nuclear testing done in the area in the 1950s. With March 1st just around the corner, we thought the timing was appropriate to bring your attention to the issues as told through the film. I interviewed Andrew Nisker, director of NUCT, and Rhea Moss Christian, a Marshallese Islander interviewed in the film, who is executive director and former chair of the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission. She previously chaired the Marshall Islands National Nuclear Commission and advised the Marshall Islands government on oceans and trade. I spoke with Andrew Nisker and Rhea Moss Christian on January 16, 2026. Andrew Nisker and Rhea Moss Christian, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Andrew, what is your background and what led you to do a film about the Marshall Islands history with U.S. nuclear weaponry?
I'm a documentarian. I've been making environmental documentaries for the past 25 years with Take Action Films, my company. And we do all sorts of issues. We were making a film about coral health and the story of corals around the world, which took us to the Bikini Atoll, where the star of our film, his grandfather was there during Operation Crossroads as part of the U.S. Army, and he was there to look at how the testing was affecting the corals, and he put cameras underwater and photographed the corals. And, you know, in that era, one of the first people to put a camera underwater to photograph corals. So we went back, and that's where I met Anderson Jeeba. And so he explained to me the story that became NUCT. But I want you to make a story about what happened to us. I left Madro saying, I want to get this film done.
And that was what year?
That was in 2019.
Rhea, you are a Marshall Islander. What was your position at the time the movie was being made and your involvement in it?
I had just finished up as chair of the Marshall Islands National Nuclear Commission when Andrew reached out. And so I agreed to contribute to the film as a former chair and as a Marshallese.
Fill us in on what we need to know about life in the Marshall Islands and what happened when the U.S. came to you saying, we want to test these bombs here.
The early testing period began right after the end of World War II. So at the end of 1945, if you look into some of the U.S. congressional testimonies, there are a number of representatives who are on different sides of the issue. Some are really concerned about what they've seen in Nagasaki and Hiroshima and believe that the U.S. does not have a moral right to continue with the development of these weapons. There are others who found what had happened in Japan to be just the beginning of what could ultimately be this U.S. military might in the world and wanted to see more of it and wanted to understand more about just how powerful these weapons could be. At that time, the Marshall Islands was coming in under the trust territory of the United States and coming under the care of the U.S. administration. And some members of Congress felt that that was a perfect location to test more of these weapons because it was out in the open ocean, far away from the United States continent. Just nothing but opportunity for some of these members. And so it was early 1946 when plans were set in place to set off to detonate the first tests in June of that year. And it was President Truman who put a pause on that in early 1946. But then that pause was lifted and the tests went ahead. And some of the objectives that were outlined in those testimonies had to do with understanding the impacts on Navy assets, in particular ships. Bringing the ships that were used in World War II to the lagoons, to the islands and the Marshall Islands, and then detonating these weapons and then looking at the impacts of those weapons on the U.S. military equipment. And it was really all about just experimentation and understanding just how powerful these are With the goal, the implication is to make the assets and make the ships and other machinery more resilient to any kind of nuclear power. And so those first tests were detonated in June of 1946 at Bikini Atoll, and then the testing series carried on from there.
What were the people of Bikini Atoll told beforehand that made them agree to evacuate their home on behalf of the United States government and this testing program?
There are some really remarkable videos, footage out there that the US created of their leaders speaking to the Bikinian leaders and explaining that this testing and their evacuation, the Bikinian people's evacuation from their island, was necessary for world peace. It was put in very simple and grand terms that would suggest that if the Bikinian people were to reject the request, that they would somehow then be responsible for more war. The characterization of the request to move and evacuate was put in those really just black and white terms. And I think there was enough understanding because of the experience in Nagasaki and Hiroshima of what these bombs, how much destruction these bombs could cause. But that was not shared with the Bikinian people, as far as we know. The depth of understanding that was available at the time was not transferred to the people to be able to make an informed decision. And so, who doesn't want to be part of creating world peace? And they were told that they could come back. And maybe the Americans believed that they could come back. But the premise was that we would evacuate, the people would evacuate, the testing would carry out, and then they would return. And of course, we know that that was not the case.
As you were learning about this story, what was it that struck you, and what was your response when you found out about this level of, one might call it, informational betrayal by the United States towards the people of the Marshall Islands?
First of all, I didn't know much about this history. Even when I went there, I was there interested in the quarrels. I had a little bit of history and background in my pocket when I went there, but coming back and going, taking a deep dive into this film, it was shocking to me because the amount of footage and documentation that we have in our film that was shot that showed by the US Army, by the Department of Energy, that documented the entire sort of process from speaking to the Bikinians to relocating them to setting up the tests to conducting the tests and conducting another test and another test and another test was how well documented this was. It seemed to me that one of the things that was really surprising to me was that not only was this probably one of the best documented moments of American history, at the time, they used all the available Kodak stock in the world during Operation Crossroads to document it. That Americans knew very little of it, nor did anybody in Canada, and it didn't seem to really be even in the history books. Something that you could have such incredible visual references to see and to learn and to study was just sitting in a vault somewhere. The stories weren't being told. And they were so well documented. That's why making this film was so exciting, because we could bring out some of those incredible images and stories. Although I feel like we were like the next wave of generation. There was a film made, Radio Bikini, that was made in the 1980s, early 1980s, that told the story, but it was sort of somewhat forgotten. And here we are, almost 30 years or 40 years later, looking at the same story again to a fresh audience. And I also feel that people have forgotten the impending sort of danger of what has come out of that era, of all the nuclear weapons that still exist and the threats that they have to humanity. We've sort of forgotten in our teachings and in the messages that come out that the shadow has it continues to cover humanity, and it's still there. And learning the lessons from from what the Bikinians went through, or the Marshallese went through, will help us prepare or come to some way to move forth and move out of this history, hopefully in a peaceful way.
Rhea, The relocation of the Marshallese from Bikini Atoll was not just a simple, okay, let's get up and move and end up someplace else. What were some of the impacts, physical and emotional and sociological, on them by having to give up their homes and then be exposed to the results of the tests?
There were endless amount of trauma in that evacuation scenario because Marshallese are identified through their connection to land. We identify in our clans, which are called Joey, to the land. And the land is, this is, I think, quite common in many cultures where the land is what gives you life and your connection to your place and your sense of belonging. And in this case, it's about where you grow your food, where you lay your head, where you do any kind of economic activity. And so being removed from that, and they were evacuated to someone else's island, you become a stranger in your country. You become a stranger in your home. And it's very difficult to plant roots on land that doesn't belong to you. I think this is quite universal. But very, very acute for the Marshallese people to be extracted from a place where they have roots and an ancestral history and placed on someone else's roots and ancestral history. And so that was traumatic in itself. And then not being able to return just means this almost permanent, perpetual exile from your roots. And that's really what comes out in this film, in the former mayor of Bikini, in his words about how his community is scattered now in different islands in the Marshall Islands, on the island of Kili and the island of Egypt. And they have placed new roots, but they all still feel a sense of removal, a sense of displacement, because it's that connection to land that is so inherent for Marshallese people.
One particularly devastating explosion that took place was Castle Bravo. It was the first hydrogen bomb. It was the largest explosion that had taken place. And there was a miscalculation as to where the fallout cloud would go afterwards, so that instead of avoiding the islands, there were people who were directly hit with the fallout from it. What was the immediate impact on the people who were hit by the radiation?
The immediate impact was a rain of fallout of radioactive ash on islands that were southwest of the detonation. We can call it a miscalculation, but I think that that is not conclusive. In some of the documents that I've seen, my belief is that the US knew that the winds had shifted and that shifting winds provided an opportunity to understand the impacts of this radiation on people, hence Project 4.1. And so the impact was immediately devastating. And there are pictures out there of children playing in ashes, thinking it was snow, and or just not knowing what it was, not knowing just how dangerous it was, and then becoming the subject of human experiments by the Brookhaven Lab. So the impact, not only to the islands that were evacuated for that bomb test to take place, but those who felt the impact of it. Now, Rongelap is probably experienced the brunt of that fallout, but many other islands were also impacted by that particular test.
You have several times referenced Project 4.1, which is something that was both outrageous and sickening. Here's an audio clip from the film citing both an official U.S. position and the Marshallese perspective.
The most highly contaminated areas of the body were the head and hair and areas of skin not protected by clothing.
I had Marshallese tell me that they had burns from the radiation that went through their skin all the way down to their bones. And they were in agony, just sheer agony. And when they were put into the Project 4.1 and they were with a doctor, the doctors took photographs of them. They didn't give them any pain relief. The idea was not to treat or assist in the healing of the patients. It was to document what the radiation does.
The exposure of these individuals afforded a unique opportunity to study the effects of radiation in man.
A full month after the event, the medical staff on Kwajalein have advised us that they anticipate no illness, barring, of course, diseases which may be hereafter contracted. The result which the scientists at Los Alamos and Livermore had hoped to obtain from these two tests were fully realized. An enormous potential has been added to our military posture by what we have learned.
And so the U.S. government enrolled the people who were exposed to radiation from Bravo in this top secret medical program without explaining what the program is, without asking for consent from any of the people.
So in other words, the Marshallese people were guinea pigs. Rhea, you're in the film talking about the U.S. government doing this because they needed a control population. What was meant by that, and what does that mean to you?
Well, I believe what was meant by that is to have a population of people who were not affected to compare to a population that was affected, so that the understanding of how radiation impacts people could be better understood. And so a control population was necessary. I mean, this is why doing any kind of medical experiments that involve people is so fraught with ethics, because it is inherently an unethical thing to do. I mean, I think that control population and the way that that control population was gathered was inhumane as well. And so it really begs the question, what was the point of that test, really? I mean, what's documented suggests that it was about understanding the power of nuclear weapons broadly and impacts on military assets more specifically. But these opportunities to study on people arose, and I think that these are opportunities that were created. And so they were taken advantage of because now they had these people that were impacted that they could then study. And this is the question of why was a laboratory leading the post-fallout studies? I mean, why were they studies? Why weren't these people being treated by medical doctors in hospitals, health institutions? Why a lab? And so all of the circumstances around that particular test and what happened afterwards suggests that this was planned in a lot of ways, and it was an opportunity that was leaned right into, and the control population was formed, and these experiments were carried out, and it really just suggests a deep, deep lack of respect for the humanity of the Marshallese people.
I would frame that as being very Mengele. To cite the Nazi doctor who experimented on prisoners of the concentration camps and committed a long list of atrocities. We'll be back with the second part of this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, well, as of this morning's internationally live-streamed announcement of the 2026 doomsday clock setting by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, it's officially 85 seconds to Armageddon. Not a pretty picture, as this symbolic clock is now 4 seconds closer to midnight than last year, and the closest it has ever been to planetary annihilation. What does this new setting mean? That we, as a planetary society, have moved closer to actually using nuclear weapons on each other, either on Earth or in space. Anything done on Earth stays on Earth, and with radiation from a nuclear bomb spread through fallout and remaining deadly for 250,000 years, none of us is or will ever be immune to its consequences. And in space, the blast from a single nuclear weapon can set up an instantaneous electromagnetic pulse, an EMP, that would fry the electricity grid and throw us all back into the Stone Age. When it comes to nukes, Tweedledum and Tweedledummer seem to be in charge. If there's any good news, it's that this annual announcement and ceremony provide one of the few times in the year when mainstream media actually looks at nuclear issues and speculates on how close to self-annihilation the human race has now brought itself to. What can be done about this trajectory of madness and bring it around? What are people already doing to achieve it? And how can you help? That's what we address on Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's why you need this show. Every week, we bring you a range of stories, interviews, and special features that allow you to understand what's going on in the nuclear world and what you can do about it. As we're learning from Minnesota, we the people are not powerless, and that includes determining the future of all things nuclear. To do that requires honest information, and one of the few places for you to find it is here every week on Nuclear Hot Seat. But we can't produce this show without your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs on donations, and without them, the show cannot continue. That's why the time would be right now to support us with a donation of any size. Go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a red donate button. Click on that and follow the prompts. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And with Zelle, there are no fees deducted. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that anything you donate is tax deductible. Any amount helps, so don't wait. Go now to nuclearhotseat.com to donate. And know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now here's the conclusion of this week's featured interview on the documentary Nuked, with director Andrew Nisker and Rhea Moss Christian, a Marshall Islander and former chair of the Marshall Islands National Nuclear Commission. Andrew, you make the point very clearly that these issues are not just about the Marshall Islands. In particular, you tie this in with the 928 weapons tests, 100 of them atmospheric, that took place in Nevada in the 1950s and 60s. What parallels did you find between the Nevada tests and the Marshall Island tests, and specifically the involvement of indigenous people?
I found the parallels. It was the same playbook that was used in Nevada, where they claimed that the Shoshone land was a land where there was nobody, or it wouldn't affect anybody. Meanwhile, the Shoshone people have been there for thousands of years. It's their sacred land. It's not scrub land or wasteland. It's sacred land. Their connection to the land is important to them, as the Marshallese connection to their own land, and that the tests were done in secrecy to the general population, and that fallout patterns continued to go over other areas of North America. Impacts are still yet to be fully understood from those tests. And we did find reports that said, you know, they saved the big bombs for the Pacific Theater and the smaller bombs for Nevada. But it was painted as in Nevada as sort of a novelty. Las Vegas was originally called the Atomic City. Come here and watch the blasts from the comfort of your hotel room. And so people never thought twice about this. But the people who lived upwind, like in St. George, Utah, suffered similar effects of people that lived in various areas of the Marshall Islands. You know, Runglep is one major story in one case, but, you know, the fact is that there were over 60 detonations done in the Marshall Islands. So the amount of fallout and effect on the population of the Marshall Islands, I think, is far more extensive than just one incident. And I think that when you look at Project 4.1, or the idea that these things were intentional, I think after a few tests, you'd understand what the bomb would do. But to continue on doing test after test after test, there's definitely intent there to see long-term damage and how it affects populations. And in Nevada, even today, you know, those areas are very radioactive. And if you speak to communities that are downwind from there, there's still a lot of unanswered questions about health concerns and issues. I mean, as far east as where I live in Toronto, the fallout has affected the production of dairy and growing of crops. And it continues to do it, I think, globally, too, from all of the tests, because there's similarities in these tests that were done in the Marshall Islands, that were done in Nevada. that were done in the deserts of the Sahara Desert, as I point out in the film, or even the ones done by the French in the South Pacific and the British in the Australian outback. You know, all these territories have been affected and subjected to extensive testing and radiation and been left, in most cases, to themselves afterwards. They haven't been cleaned up. There's no studies going on to an extensive way where we set open the legacy of these tests and also the byproducts of these tests. As I show, nuclear radiation, nuclear waste being put in barrels and dumped off ships in the middle of the ocean or actually just off the coast of Los Angeles and New York are still sitting there. Those barrels are still sitting there. And they say that they're fine because they're not being disturbed. But recently I read an article when they were looking down at them, they glow. It's only so long that these things will be contained in this metal. So it's a real interesting area to keep pushing forth and ask questions about and study to understand the impact that these weapons have.
And the long-lasting nature of the impact that they have.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a genocide that hasn't stopped for people from health perspectives. It affects generation after generation. It's kind of like the use of Agent Orange in Vietnam. There's still, you know, and there will be generation after generations of people being affected by being exposed to those chemicals. Their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren are being born with health effects, birth defects that will continue on.
As you just referenced, you also included footage in the film on Australia and French Polynesia, the French tests, and the climate change-threatened Runit Dome, which is the radioactive waste dump in the Pacific that is being threatened by rising sea level. What is the current status there, and what are we facing from Runit Dome?
So it's important to understand, first of all, how Runit Dome is built. It's built above a crater that was created by one of the bombs at Inuituk Atoll. And that crater was then filled with debris that was collected on the island from the testing activities, And a lot of that debris was radioactive. It contained a number of radionuclides. There were many layers. There were about three or four layers, I believe, in that dome of waste. And then it was covered with a concrete cap. The radioactive part of the waste under that dome, we're told, is at the top layer of that. The dome is unlined. And so what's happening is that as the tide comes up in the lagoon, it is mixing with the sediments under that dome because it's unlined. So water at high tide is mixing with the sediment under that dome, and it's potentially releasing radionuclides into the environment. Now, what we know from the Department of Energy studies is that most of the radiation on Inuituk and the island where the Runit Dome is located, most of the radiation is actually outside of the dome. And we're told that less than 1% of the radiation there is in the dome. And so what we need to understand from that is while the dome is a physical structure and something that we can, radiation that we can see in some ways, the larger concern is all of the radiation that continues to sit outside of that dome and in the lagoon floor, in particular in the lagoon sediment in the deep parts of the lagoon, and the impacts on the environment, the marine environment, and the surrounding vegetation around the dome. Now, that said, I mean, we still don't want that dome to crumble and fall apart and disperse into the ocean. But I think those numbers are quite important to understand when we're talking about the dome, that it's not just, we're not isolating this conversation to that physical structure, but we're looking at the surrounding environment around the dome and the overall impacts of having that dome located there and constructed in the way that it is.
Now, in 1968, the people who had been removed from Bikini Atoll were allowed to return, and many of them did. Yet in 1978, they left again. What happened to them when they returned, and why did they decide to leave?
Well, they returned on the understanding and the advice that their island was safe. But that didn't turn out to be true because you cannot completely remove radiation from the environment. You can make it safer for people to inhabit, But you cannot clean it in the way that we think of, in the sense that we think of cleaning something. So it's not simply just removing it. That radiation will always linger somewhere in the background in the environment, and it'll come up through the vegetation and the roots. It'll live in the air and the particles that people are breathing. And so people went back and they continued to get sick. And the US continued to monitor. And so that ongoing medical research, maybe some treatment, was continued through that time. And then the people asked to be removed again because the sicknesses were so prevalent and people did not feel safe in their back on their land. And they knew that something was still wrong. And it was probably the presence of ongoing doctors or researchers that didn't give them that much comfort either. So it's just this perpetuation of illness and studies and families getting sick from being back on their land. And so, of course, naturally, they want to leave again. And so they were removed again, as you said, in the late 70s, and they have not returned. So that was another dark period of trauma, another layer of trauma on these people who had been separated once and then having to be separated again, and now with illness.
What kind of acknowledgement has the United States given as to what it actually did? And what kind of compensation have they provided, if any, for the Marshallese people affected in this way?
When the Marshall Islands negotiated independence from the US, there was acknowledgement in the Compact of Free Association through the establishment of a nuclear claims tribunal. And that tribunal was established to receive and adjudicate claims of harm against individuals and harm against land. So there were personal injury claims and there were property damage claims. That is an implicit acknowledgement that there are harms that need to be addressed. But the request from the Marshall Islands to replenish the funds for the tribunal, because there was so much more damage than was originally known at the time the tribunal was established, was rejected by the US, by the Bush administration at the time, who considered that the circumstances had not changed in the sense that was envisioned under the Compact of Free Association that would warrant a replenishment of funds for the tribunal. And so, in some ways, it was an initial acknowledgement, but with very, very tight limitations that were not known to the Marshallese people at the time. It was not expected that this could be something that could be so finite, that there could be an end necessarily. Beyond that establishment of the tribunal and that legal process and that process of gathering evidence and making claims and issuing awards, there have been efforts by some in the US to seek an apology but from the US government, a formal apology. I think that's fine in my personal view. I think an apology is fine, but an apology needs to come with corrective action in this case. And I think that's something that is just far more complex and difficult and challenging to achieve, especially now. And so that acknowledgement that those harms are still ongoing continues to diminish from the US side. The passage of time doesn't help. There are fewer people, I believe, in US government who have a strong understanding of what happened in the 1940s and 50s in the Marshall Islands, and how that has continued to impact the Marshallese people. And let's face it, there are a lot of issues that have taken over and are consuming people's attention. This is in many ways history, and that's why this film is so important in other conversations like this, because we have to keep telling this story because it's not over.
I agree, the story is not over. The film came out in 2024. How was it received at the time, and what kind of impact has it had?
Within our own audience and film festivals related to nuclear issues, we've done quite well. We've won some great audience awards or bigger awards, but it really never found much of a festival life. But now, with Al Jazeera picking up the film, discovering it, bringing it to its audience, which is a massive audience, I think that it's going to be a megaphone for the film. And it's given us another level of prestige to help bring the story out there. And I think when people learn it or see it, they are absolutely flabbergasted. And so that, to me, is an incredible, that's the reason I made it, really, is to get the story out there, because it's not just a Marshall Lee story, it's the story of humanity. This is where we are. We've been affected by these things and we need to figure out a new way. And so the film opens that conversation in that respect too. And I feel like it's very hard today to get people's attention. It's very hard to get people's attention to serious issues. Or it's very hard for documentary to do well these days. People, if they want to watch documentary, they're more interested in The Housewives of Beverly Hills than they are about serious issues. And also, people are not so interested about long-form films either anymore. The younger generation likes short TikTok sort of snippets to get them engaged. And, you know, that's one avenue. If we had more time or funding, I could take this film and all the interviews we shot that we didn't use in the film and make shorter films out of it to get people's attention, to drive them towards the larger film. And maybe that'll be a project I do one day. But right now, I think the Al Jazeera deal and getting it out there through that network has been an absolute miracle. It's a blessing. So I do hope it does have some impact, because it doesn't happen too often that you can get a platform like that.
At the end of the film, there's a screen card that states that a new memorandum of understanding was signed between the U.S. and the Republic of the Marshall Islands in 2023, promising more money and more control over how the money is spent. And it tied the extension of this memorandum to the U.S. continuing to have exclusive military rights to the Pacific region. Has this come about?
So that was a continuation of our bilateral agreement between our governments, the Compact of Free Association, which provides the U.S. with defensive rights over the Marshall Islands territory. That is not new in that 2023 agreement. That's just simply an extension of the arrangement that was made when it was first signed in 1986. The funding that came along with the renewal of the agreement and the vague language that is used around the purpose is deliberate. And that is deliberate to not recognize ongoing nuclear harms, which is a rejection in many ways by the U.S. that nuclear harms continue. From the other side, from the Marshall Islands side, that funding is earmarked for nuclear harms. But now that's a battle that the Marshall Islands needs to go through again to figure out a framework for how that funding should be distributed. The tribunal still exists, although it is defunct, but by law, it is still a legal institution in the Marshall Islands. Outside of that tribunal process, there is no other framework that we can lean on. We would have to create a new framework for distributing compensation from those funds that came through the renewal of the compact in 2023.
Is there anything we haven't covered that either one of you would like to share at this time?
You asked earlier what life was like in the Marshall Islands, and I got off on the tangent about how the testing, the conversation in the U.S. came about in late 1945, and I didn't talk about the Marshallese side. You know, the Marshall Islands had been the center of a lot of World War II battles and was occupied by the Japanese before the U.S. took under trusteeship. Marshallese people lived peacefully and in harmony with their land for centuries before foreign impact and influence. My grandfather was half Japanese. That's how much Japanese influence is in the Marshall Islands. And before the U.S. nuclear testing program, Marshallese people didn't have these serious illnesses that they're facing now, these cancers. It's very hard to speak to any Marshallese who doesn't have some kind of a cancer story or doesn't have some connection to someone who has been harmed by the nuclear testing. And I think what's really sad and tragic for me is that generation of Marshallese people, they've either passed away already or they're old. They're the older generation, and we're losing those stories because it's hard for people to talk about. which is why the documentation is so important, so we can educate our next generation. But the tragic piece is that generations from now, Marshallese will still be dealing with these impacts. And this is a legacy, a very sad and dark legacy that will just continue because radiation cannot clean it from the environment, especially not at the scale that was deposited throughout the Marshall Islands. I don't think the Bikinians for generations will ever be able to return to their island. In Uetok, where the dome is, there's a community living there. They will continue to be affected. There are cumulative impacts of being exposed to radiation. I believe that everyone should have an interest. As Andrew said, this is a story of humanity. And Marshall Islands is a very big part of that important story. And I worry about our future generations who won't have the knowledge that they need in order to address the harms that they will be facing. It's not if, it is known. They will be facing these harms. And so I hope that we get more of these conversations out into the mainstream and that there are ways to grab the attention and the interest of young people in particular. And young people, of course, these will be our leaders someday. And they will need to be armed with this information in order to have any ability to address what will continue to be harm to their land and themselves and their people.
It's fortunate that among other resources out there that the film Nuked does exist because it is so thorough and so deeply moving and allowing the Marshallese to speak for themselves throughout.
We try to make these historical stories very engaging and memorable and to inspire people to take action. So please do check it out.
The film is called Nuked. It is available on many platforms, which we will link to at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode. And for now, I want to thank you, Andrew Nisker and Rhea Moss Christian, for joining us and informing the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat.
That was awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Andrew Nisker, director of the award-winning documentary Nuked, and Rhea Moss Christian, a Marshall Islander who was interviewed in the film and is the former chair of the Marshall Islands National Nuclear Commission. Nuked has just been picked up for international distribution by Al Jazeera Media Network, a Qatari-based international news organization. We'll have a link up to where you can view the film for free on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 761. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, January 13, 2026. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and there is a yellow box that will pop up. It's an opt-in box, so just put in your first name and your email address, and every week you will get one email from us, which includes a link to that week's show, as soon as it posts, as well as a brief description of some of the content. That way, you never need to risk missing out on a single episode. And if there's a particular topic you are interested in researching, just use the little search function and you got 761 episodes to go through to find a featured interview on exactly whatever nuclear topic you want to know more about. Here's a call for audience participation. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that information via email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you, yay, please. Any amount will help us out, and we will really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights are reserved, but fair use is allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, said, the problem of nuclear weapons ends by its use or its elimination. Let's hope it's the latter. And there you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, Do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.